Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are brothers who share a passion for politics and international affairs. Professor David Farrell is professor at the School of Politics and International Relations in University College Dublin, and his brother Theo is professor of war in the modern world at King's College London. Their dad is Brian Farrell, a much-loved broadcaster and himself a highly regarded academic in the field of politics and associate professor in UCD for many years. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
That's a lot of professors in your family.
Well, there's a lot of us. So, I mean, some of us had to sort of follow in Dad's career, but not that many, I think.
Family trade.
I obviously have to declare an interest. I think one of the nicest, most decent, kindest men I ever worked with was your father. At what stage when you were growing up did you realise he was on the telly as such?
In the very early days, I think he must have been on Frank Hall's, whatever, Newsbeat, I think it was called. And he'd be on the TV screen. But we actually thought that he was inside the TV, and he for a while would sort of try and fool us. There was a little entry point and you go in, and that worked for a few times. It was once a week or whatever it was. And then I just developed the idea that the only way they could get him on the TV was for him to climb up the mast. You know, this big RTE mast outside?
Yeah, outside here.
And that was where the studio was. So I was convinced throughout my childhood that that's where every night he would climb up his mast. And that's where he was, you know, being broadcast from.
And you, Theo?
For me, I think the thing that I found most impressive was not that he was on television interviewing all these famous people. It was how he interacted with ordinary people. Mm. He was famous at the time, and he wore his fame very easily. I mean, he was all about putting people at ease, and you know, he was just very relaxed about it. And yeah. I just thought that was so impressive. Mm.
Almost everywhere I go, somebody has had some encounter with Dad. And it's exactly what they always say, you know, a real gent. I mean, the other difference, of course, is that we're in a culture now where there's Twitter and Facebook, yeah. And you'll know all about that. And in fact, we were with him last Saturday and he was asking, what is this thing you call Facebook? Because he's completely, it's beyond him. You know, he'd never used computers. And he was saying, what's the point? But what I think it says a lot about was at his time, celebrities were celebrities in for what they did, not what their personal lives were about. So there was a mutual respect, I think, between the celebrity and the audience that I think is long gone now.
He was a superb broadcaster. He would be laughing and having fun with the floor manager. And then he would go in and literally grill somebody in an interview with incredible ease and then be polite at the end of it.
Yeah. I also remember, I mean, Dad is colorblind. And so, you know, it was up to Mum to make sure that the whatever outfit he was putting together was the correct one. And every once in a while, a taxi would be sent back from RTE to get a different tie, because Dad had gone into the studio with, you know, a tie that just simply did not work.
And you, was it true you delivered some shirts during one election?
It was Bernard and Miriam. They were told to get into the taxi
Your
and deliver
and
some
sister,
shirts.
Yeah,
my brothers and sister. And it was, you know, the marathon sessions that you go through nowadays, yeah. I suppose. And they arrived and they were ushered into the studio and told to wait because they were about to go to an ad break. And then Dad stood up to go and meet them, and he was wearing boxer shorts. So all through the programme, he'd been dressed beautifully above, but below, revealing everything.
Why?
I don't know. Heat? It was a summer.
Heat.
It was the
70s.
It was
incredibly hot. Roasting those studios.
Yeah, it was incredibly hot.
The Dickie Bows.
Oh, I'd forgotten about the Dickie Bows. That was an innovation.
Yeah.
And I think that was a style innovation. And it was Mum's attempt to, I suppose, you know, reinvent his image. You know, you have to reinvent yourselves. But for me, actually, it's funny. The thing I also remember, I think of all these, the various programs he went through, 7 days.
Today, Tonight.
Prime Farrell time. And not Prime Time. Was those famous debates between Charlie High and Gareth Fitzgerald. Those marathon debates. And what was interesting was, I mean, Dad was good friends with Gareth Fitzgerald. Mm. Yeah. But if you look at those debates, when he stepped into the room and he was professional, he you know, dished it out equally tough to both sides. I mean, it was thoroughly professional.
He grilled them all.
Yes.
Garrotted them all.
Yeah. And it was his duty to do so, right?
Absolutely.
It was his duty to hold senior leaders to account. And that's exactly what he did.
But he always kept respect. This was the thing that always marked him out from a lot of the contemporary journalists, I think, certainly the ones I experienced in Britain on the airways. Respect for the institutions and for the people who have to keep them going, rather than going in and attacking them on personal issues.
Yes. But still asking always the really tough
questions.
Very
tough questions.
Yes.
Growing up, where did you both come in your family, and how many siblings are in your family?
Well, 7. So I was I was exactly in the middle. So it's Naomi, Bernard and Miriam in quick succession. A bit of a gap, then it's me, then it's Rachel, and then it's the twins, it's Theo and Brian.
So you were a joint baby?
A non-identical twin.
What's it like being a twin?
It's fabulous. It's somebody out there who you have an incredibly close connection. And Dad had a very good observation on this. He once watched the family, we all got together for a big meal, this many years ago, and Dad was watching us, and he said afterwards, you know, the amazing thing about you and Brian is when you talk, you look each other straight in the eye for long periods of time. And it's not something you naturally do. There's very few people you'll naturally look straight in the eye, but it just comes completely naturally to us.
It's because you shared a womb.
And a room. You shared a womb and a room.
A womb and a room.
For many years. So we were always very close.
Now, how was David to you? He was an older brother to you. Was he good to you, Theo?
Oh, God.
David, he was a great brother. So, because he was always the big brother who would play with us. And I grew up, I was mad about war games. He would play war games with me all the time. He was very tolerant. But he was also, I remember, David was a big fan of Lord of the Rings and
still
The Hobbit.
Yeah.
He still is. He's a very loyal fan. And the J.R. Tolkien calendar that he illustrated beautifully, and David's telling us the story of the Hobbit using the calendar.
Wow.
And it was amazing. I remember that, actually, distinctly. And you know, he was a great brother.
And how was Theo as a little brother? Was he annoying?
No. I think Brian probably would be. No, not in the slightest. No, Theo was amazing to. Now that I know where he's ended up in terms of his career.
Yeah.
Dad was always good when we were very young, where he'd come home with these big, huge pieces of paper. I don't know where he got them from. They'd fill the size of a table. And crayons or, you know, markers or pens or whatever it was. And then put you in a corner and you just get on and draw a picture and just be good. And that was Dad's way of keeping you under control. And we all did various pictures, but I always remember with Theo, it was pictures of war scenes.
It's amazing.
Intricate, elaborate, and tanks and guns and all this sort of stuff. And from the very beginning, this is where Theo was going, war.
And you never diverted.
Looks like I didn't. No.
And when you were at home, it must have been quite a busy household, was it, with seven children? Your mum, of course, she's top dog in the house, is she?
Oh, she's the matriarch. To this day, all decisions are mum's. She runs the family.
I think what's so amazing is, you know, seven kids, many animals.
Yeah.
Surely that's enough to be getting on with. But mum kept an open home. So
yes.
We would have, in addition to all various people who come through, like, you know, the Upward people come to Dublin, you know, that Upward people. We always had one of those folks staying with us. There was constant strangers coming and staying. And mum's philosophy was it was good to have people coming through the house and for us as kids to meet them. But also, more importantly, she was incredibly welcoming of our friends.
Yeah.
So I constantly had all my friends through the house. And I went through a phase much later on of Dungeons and Dragons, you know, as a teenager. And we would have these marathon sessions and mum would produce whole cakes. You know, she would just ply us with food and cakes. And you know, basically, she made a home that was incredibly welcome for everyone. But I think that's incredible. I mean, my wife and I, we have one kid who's brilliant. I couldn't imagine having, you know, what, 10, 12 people through your house? It's incredible.
But she ran the house sort of like a military operation. So we all had duties, and the duties would vary. Like, I was a potato peeler and chopper. I'm brilliant at peeling potatoes.
Are you still good at that?
Day. Very good at that.
Excellent.
But, you know, then you'd move on to another phase, vacuuming the house or whatever it was. But it meant that the jobs were done and everything, the house was always shipshape.
There's the old story about, you know, that behind every successful man, there's a woman. Well, in mum's case, that was more than literally true.
Mm.
Now, you're both academics. Were you both super smart in school?
I wasn't. No, I was a dunce. I was in Gonzaga and I was pulled out of there by my mother because it was clear I wasn't going to go anywhere.
There's a particular story about that. So actually what happened is mum goes into Gonzaga and...
We're talking about David now.
David now. This is one of the stories in the family that's legend. She goes into Gonzaga and she has a good conversation with the teacher because David is just not doing very well in class. And the teacher sits down with the teacher. The teacher goes... Well, Mrs. Farrell, I'm afraid to tell you that your boy's just not that bright. You know, he's never going to come to much. And mum just explodes. You know, this is a very bad idea to say this kind of thing to mum. And she pulls David out.
So I was in Benilda's with him the next week. But still average, always average. And then I arrived in university. And it was just a revelation, a whole different style of learning. And I was very lucky. I fell in with a real nerdy crowd. So I wasn't into sports or, you know, nightclubs or all that sort of stuff. We were into very serious, engaged conversations. And so, you know, that was the making of me in a sense, that I discovered I loved learning and I loved university.
That group, they were very formative. And you actually developing both as an academic and as a human being.
Yes. I mean, there were various members of the group, but there was a core of four of us. And we'd all been in the same school. We'd all come from Benilda's and then went into university. We all did economics as a joint subject. And Thatcher had just been elected and Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek were all in the news. So we always were talking about this. And to this day, those of us who are still around remain very good friends. You know, we still meet up now and again and have a bit too much to drink and sort of talk about the old days.
And sadly, one of that group died, didn't they, David?
Yeah, Michael was diagnosed with leukemia in the early 1990s. And we all the friends, as many of us as possible, went on bone marrow banks all over the world. I was in England by then. And unfortunately, he didn't survive. But what was very, what I found anyway for me that helped me a lot in terms of getting some kind of closure was a couple of years later, I'd long since forgotten I was on the bone marrow bank. I got contacted about a possible match. And I did. I had a match. And so had the opportunity to donate some bone marrow. And the young boy in Canada, a young baby that who was diagnosed with a very serious immune deficiency, I think it's called SCIDS, who would have died. He was living in a bubble for 14 months, but he didn't have cancer. So all he needed was a good match for the bone marrow. And he had the operation and survived. He's a 17-year-old boy in Canada. Mm. We meet up now and again. We are Facebook buddies and everything. So it was very nice to have had that opportunity to do something in memory of Michael.
That's really nice, actually. And you, Theo?
I developed even more late than that. So I was, like David, I was a very unremarkable school student. And I just barely scraped into UCD. And I was a terrible student. I failed first year philosophy. No one fails first year philosophy. And I was in my third year. And Dad was teaching me and David was teaching me, you know, both of them. Dad called me into the office. And I thought, oh, God, here, I'm going to get the lecture, you know, about how I need to pull my socks up. But he said something remarkable. Instead of appealing to, you know, my future career and, you know, he was very blunt. He said, do you have any idea how embarrassing it will be for me if you fail third year politics? And then I realized, you know, there's a broader responsibility here. It's just not about me. And I pulled my socks up. And that changed everything for me. Of course, Dad was a role model and an inspiration. But actually, David was a more important role model because David was my brother. And by the time I was in third year in college and David was teaching, I could see, oh, there's a career here. Mm-hmm. And I took David's class and which was on elections. And that was amazing to see him teach. I mean, he was a fantastic teacher. But it was quite amusing because the front row were all the young women batting the eyelids at David as he was lecturing.
Did it put pressure on you, though, Theo, to be lectured, I suppose, in UCD by your father and your brother?
Yeah, no, there's no question about that. There was pressure there. Yeah, but obviously...
You survived it.
I survived. Yeah, it worked. Yeah, it worked.
I assume you were discussing politics a lot around the kitchen table, were you?
Oh, yes. During the week, we would actually eat separately in the kitchen. And because Dad would come home from his day in UCD teaching and have to go out in the evening, we would bring the meals in on a tray to Mum and Dad. But in the weekends, it was the big family meal around the table. And then politics was the topic of conversation. And I remember as a teenager, you know, I think when you're young, you tend to be more conservative or more right wing. And as you get older, you become more sensible, basically, and more liberal. But I remember spouting the most ridiculous views on Reagan and Thatcher, quite supportive of them. And my dad sort of very tolerant, not even raising his eyes, but I imagine internally raising his eyes thinking, oh, God, what is he talking about? And we'd talk through the politics. And so that was a great education, actually.
But you also had great fun. Didn't you go to Clare a lot when you were children, County Clare?
Our parents sort of fell in love with County Clare. I don't understand exactly how it happened, but sometime in the early 1970s, we were suddenly being dragged to Kilkee. And Kilkee was a very happening place. It still is. It's a wonderful, wonderful town. And renting a place, different places every year. And then suddenly it was decided to build a holiday home in Clare, just south of Doombeg. A most beautiful bit of headland. And that was where we went. A minibus full of all the kids, all our bikes and two cats that didn't know what was going on, dragged across the west of Ireland.
Did the cats go with you?
The cats went with us. And there was no sense of, you know, you need to lock the cat in and butter its paws and all. They were just fecked outside of the van as soon as we arrived. And if they survived, they survived. And they did survive.
Did your mom open a restaurant in the house?
Yeah, I can distinctly remember. She's hilarious. When I was in Benilde's, I was very lucky that every lunchtime I'd cycle home and have lunch in the kitchen with my parents. A bowl of homemade potato soup. And I still to this day will remember the day that Mum announced to Dad that she was going to turn the house into a restaurant. He went grey immediately. Seriously, overnight he went grey. Because it was a mad idea, you know. This was a place, the west of Ireland in those days, where, you know, your idea of vegetables was potatoes, turnips and carrots. But this was going to be high cuisine. And she still managed to have, I always remember the recipe, you know, it was going to be, or the menu, it was homemade pate, it was You know, beautiful steak with a homemade garlic sauce. It was salmon, homemade ice creams, a beautiful bread-flavoured ice cream.
Oh, my gosh.
Absolutely yes. Wonderful restaurant. And people were driving from all over because in those days, there was no such thing as high cuisine, you know, west of the Shannon, certainly.
But whoa, just to say, this house that you used as a holiday home, your mother turned it into a restaurant.
Except for a little room at the back where Theo and Brian could go and play their war games because they were too young. So the rest of us
weren't. What was it called?
Collard restaurant.
Yep.
No telephone, no internet. So the local postmistress in Doonbeg would take bookings and we'd have to go off every day to the local village to learn who was coming that
How long did the restaurant last for?
It's about 3 summers, I think.
Maybe a bit longer, but it was just a few years and then the house was bought.
But how did the restaurant go?
Packed. I mean, it was very successful.
Good for your mother.
People come from, but I guess it was a project for Mum. And I think it was difficult for Dad in that he would come on holiday and he would be serving in the restaurant. What kind of holiday is that?
Well, he was the wine waiter. And problem was, I think the first year it opened was the year when the popes kept dying. It was whatever summer that was.
Yeah.
And of course, in those days, he was the one who had to cover the funeral, but also cover the, you know, instigation of the new pope and whatever. So I had to take over as wine waiter. I don't know, I was about 14 or 15. I didn't know anything about wine, but I'm sort of recommending this particular one with your meal and everything.
Because you like to shave in the bottle.
Yeah, exactly. It was crazy.
But the people must have been amazed because your father obviously would be on the television one night and the next night serving them.
I think that was certainly a draw for the first year, and that probably helped the success of the restaurant. But people came back for the food. And we knew how good the food was because we were being, you know, Mum was so busy, she didn't have time to cook a separate meal for us. So the one upside of the whole experience was we ate like kings for about 3 summers because we had the food they were serving in the restaurant. It was a duck dish that Mum used to do. That
Ducking
was
around.
Absolutely amazing.
And then they stink all day making it.
Quite. But, you know, I was acceptable. I was acceptable cost.
But look, the first piece of music is a song that reminds you both of County Clare, the Elton John song.
Amarina.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, Tumbleweed Connection, the album it comes from, was one which sort of evokes images of beautiful hot summer's days. And County Clare was pretty much the opposite of that, but still beautiful nonetheless, but lovely windswept walks and then coming home for cups of tea and playing board games inside. And Amarina was the sort of song that we would have been listening to at that stage.
Yeah, you remember being out and about and running around the countryside, climbing over the cliffs, but actually an awful lot of our time was inside where it was raining, playing cards and listening to Elton John.
Elton John's there, Amarina, reminds you both of your holidays in County Clare. Your mum, of course, comes from a good political family, doesn't she, Theo?
Yes, I suppose the closest thing to Irish royalty, if you can put it that way. You know, her great-grandfather was John Dillon, who was deputy leader and then for a period leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party. So she comes from a tradition of parliamentary politics. And of course, there's a funny story about when Dad first brought Mum home to meet his parents in Manchester.
Yeah.
Dad's family were all Republicans. And so there's a great division, obviously, in Irish politics between the constitutional nationalists and the Republican nationalists. And so as the story goes, Dad brings Mum home to his parents. And my grandparents in Manchester would be thrown out of halls for, you know, chanting Republican stuff and so forth. And my grandmother says to my dad, "Never did I think that a son of mine would bring the granddaughter of John Dillon across this threshold." And then there was great laughter about it.
But that was something you were aware of growing up, was it, David, both of you?
Yeah, I mean, certainly my first political memory is formed around that because Mum was very active in Dublin South Fine Gael in those days, 1970s, 1973 election, when Richard Burke, as named then, was picked as the candidate. And I was a schoolboy, a 12-year-old, and I remember coming home in the evenings to the smoke-filled room. And I had a particular job, which was this, that Richard Burke had another candidate with the same surname on the ballot paper, whose first name was going to be put him higher on the ballot paper than Richard. So Richard became Dick overnight. But they printed all the leaflets. So my job as a 12-year-old was to sit in this room crossing out Richard and writing Dick on all the leaflets that would go out after. So that was, I always remember that period, and it really got me into politics at that point.
Never thought about standing for politics?
No.
No.
That's a definite no.
No, I have huge respect, a genuinely huge respect for people who have the courage to do that. I mean, that is not a life that I would ever want. And, you know, I really think we should recognise the role that politicians have to play for all their faults and failings from time to time. I'd never have the courage to do that.
How come your father was born in Manchester, and how did he come back here?
Well, his family would have been emigrants, I suppose, and they were Mancunians. I mean, there's still a lot of Farrells in Manchester. I've met a load of them in my years living there. So he lived there with a bunch of brothers and a sister, and then the war broke out, and he was the youngest son, and he was below the age to be called up. And they decided, because, of course, Manchester was not going to be safe with all the bombings and everything, the family decided to send him to live with an aunt in Dublin. So he arrived in Dublin, went straight to Colosta Burr. As he said, he had to learn Latin through Irish, knowing neither language when he started, and stayed in Dublin from there on.
Dad is christened Bernard Brendan. So he isn't christened Brian. There's Brian nowhere on the birth cert. And the relatives in Dublin got terribly confused, and half of them would call him Bernard and half would call him Brendan. And this Irish aunt said, oh, the boy is going to get terribly confused. Let's just call him Brian. So Brian stuck. And that's where he got his name.
Interestingly, though, you both emigrated. You ended up going back to where your dad was born in Manchester. Why did you go to Manchester?
Well, I got a job. I mean, it was 1987. We were in another recession and there was no job. There were no possibility of any job in Dublin. So a job came up in Manchester and I moved there, and it was going to be for 1 year. And I ended up, apart from a short break to go to Cardiff, I ended up in Manchester for the best part of 21 years. I mean, Manchester is the most wonderful of cities. I loved my time in Manchester. I really loved it.
Did you mind leaving it?
No, I mean, I never really settled in Britain. I never really felt that this was going to be... I think Theo's got a very different attitude about moving to Britain and settling in Britain. I always felt I was Irish. If anyone ever asked me when I was overseas where I came from, I always said, I'm from Ireland, but I live in England. So I never really felt at home there, despite the friendliness of the place. And so when an opportunity finally came in 2009 to come back to Ireland, I jumped at it.
And that's when you came back here as Professor of Politics in UCD. Yes. And you, Theo, so are you English?
I am actually British, yes.
You had to renege on your citizenship, isn't that it?
Yes, because I do some work for the British government and it requires that I'm a British citizen to do so. But for me, it wasn't a difficult decision. As you doubtless know, Irish citizens are not foreign subjects in British law. So there's always been this very close relationship, culturally, politically, economically, of course, between Ireland and Britain. And I do lots of work in the British military, overseas, etc. And a lot of them are Irish. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're chatting to these people wearing British uniforms and they're Irish. Three of our uncles fought in the British Army mm-hmm. in World War II. One lost his life. So for me, it was completely natural. I see myself as an Irish person who happens to be British, and there's no contradiction whatsoever.
Take me back, why you went to London and what you do. I know you're a professor in King's College.
I moved to London because there's a world famous Department of War Studies in London. It's the mecca of war studies, as it's been described. So for me, it was no decision whatsoever. I was offered a job. I went straight away. But for my wife and I, it was a good move as well because we love London. We love the multiculturalism of London. And now, of course, I'm just about to take over as head of this department. And so yet again, I'm following in David's footsteps because he's head of Department of Politics here in Dublin.
Your particular area of interest is Afghanistan, isn't it?
That's correct. I work on the war in Afghanistan.
What do you do?
Well, obviously, as an academic, I study it. But increasingly, academics are being called upon to go out and engage in the real world and talk to real people and find out what's happening beyond the books. In my case, I do quite a lot of work with the ISAF and the British government, and that means I travel back and forth to Afghanistan. I've just come back. I was there a month ago for a month doing work in Kabul. And it's fantastic to be somebody who is studying a war and actually to be able to go in and have a really close look at the conflict.
From a woman's perspective, it just seems such a strange country.
In many respects, it's very alien and very strange. And when you fly around, I mean, I've flown all over the country at helicopters and planes, and you literally see what it looks like. It's alien landscape. And when you're on the ground, I've travelled around quite a bit on the ground in Helmand. What's really striking, by the way, is you don't see women. You just do not see women on the ground. And that's because in the south and the east of Afghanistan, it's a deeply conservative rural society. and women are just hidden away. Whereas when you go to Kabul, yeah, it's completely different again. It's a very bustling, busy city. The infrastructure's all crumbling. The buildings are full of holes from the wars. But you see, you know, traditionally dressed people. You see women in burqas, but you see many more women actually in Western dress running around with simply a scarf over their heads. And this is the thing about Afghanistan. I mean, we understand there's tribal divisions and tribal splits, but actually I think possibly even more important is the division between an increasingly young urban population that wants everything that young urbanites want in the world, and then this deeply conservative rural population in the south and the east.
When you go there, do you worry for your own safety? Because any time you read about what's happening, whether in the Helmand province, it just seems incredibly dangerous.
Yes, I mean, our perception of danger is greater than the actuality of it. I mean, in Kabul, there's a very heavy military presence. When you're picked up at the airport, you get straight into an armored car. You're driven straight to the headquarters of ISAF. It's a heavily guarded place.
What does ISAF stand for?
It's the International Security Assistance Force. It's the NATO force, which has Irish troops in it as well. I've met them when I was out there. So it's actually very safe, Kabul, if you look at the statistics. Helmand's a different kettle of fish. And in 2010 and 2009, I was around Helmand quite a bit. And then wherever you go, you're surrounded by armed bodyguards. Mm-hmm. They will move you quite quickly through the terrain. But I only once felt that, oh dear, this doesn't look very good. And we were on the ground in a village, and there was some wheat seed distribution. It's part of the anti-drug program. And there was gunfire. And all of a sudden, our bodyguards just grabbed us and moved us very quickly back to the base. In fact, what they said was, we want you now to move quickly but calmly back to the base. And everyone turned around and just legged it. But beyond that, actually, the actuality is that it's not as dangerous as we think. It's incredibly dangerous for the soldiers who are literally on the front line. But I'm not on the front line, never have been, and have no intention to go near it.
It's interesting, though, you go there as an academic. Do you get to meet the Taliban?
Not in Afghanistan. Because it's too dangerous. But I have met Taliban in the Gulf, in Dubai. And this is work I've done with a remarkable Irishman called Michael Semple, who works at Harvard. He's a leading authority in the Taliban. And he's a very strong advocate of the need for a negotiated settlement. And so Michael and I have done some work together where we have been interviewing senior leaders in the Taliban to try and look at, you know, to what extent is there a real view within the Taliban leadership favouring a negotiated settlement? What are the terms of a settlement, and then try and bring those views to Western policymakers. And I think increasingly they are being heard. I mean, this conflict, if it is going to end, has going to have to involve some degree of negotiation.
And is the reason you had to, I suppose, become a British citizen exclusively, because that's the only way you could do this work? Could you do this work if you're an Irish citizen?
You could do, obviously, the work talking to the Taliban about the possibility of negotiation. But the work that I do when I go to Afghanistan with the British military and with ISAF, the NATO military, involves using highly classified material. Mm. And so, no, you couldn't do it otherwise.
It's probably no surprise for you, David, since he spent his childhood playing war games, that he'd end up studying war games at this stage of his life.
I know. I mean, my life feels so mundane in comparison to the sort of things that Theo gets up with. I mean, when he's down there, he's flying in helicopter gunships. It's a sort of thing like out of a Vietnam movie.
More exciting than domestic politics?
No, of course not. No. It's a different kind of exciting. Different kind of exciting.
But look, we'll take the next piece of music, which Theo is the song you want.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Yes. So this is a band called Cake. What I love about them is their lyrics are so creative. They're so amusing, these lyrics. But this song in particular means a lot to me because if you listen to the lyrics, the narrator of the song describes a woman who is confident. She's self-confident, she's independent. And so the relationship, if you want to have a relationship with her, you have to accept this. And for me, it reminds me of my wife. You know, she's a professor of international law at the University of Westminster. Very independent, self-confident woman, Hélène. And it also, it really is what we aspire for our daughter, Eloise. She is growing up to be a remarkable young woman. And it's what we would hope for her as she grows up.
And listen, is it true that you met your wife the day you met her? You moved in with her?
We were introduced by a friend of ours. Basically, he works in IT, and we were the two academics that he knew. So he assumed we would get on. We were much more sceptical. But we did get on, and we met for lunch. And then I met her that evening at a disco, and I moved in that night, and I've never moved out.
That was swift.
It was quick. Well, you know, if you want something, you have to go for it.
she swings her arms instead of her hips. When she talks, she moves her mouth instead of her lips.
Your choice there, Theo Farrell. I'm here this morning, by the way, with Theo and David Farrell, both professors. Cake, Let Me Go. Just thinking, if that song is all about the independence of strong women, and you mentioned that before we played it, and how you'd love your daughter to grow up like that. So when you work in somewhere like Afghanistan, where women are simply downtrodden and hardly seen, how does that make you feel?
In the urban society in Afghanistan, women are very active. They're liberated and they have voice. It's in the rural society that they don't. But I still don't think it's our business to be fighting a war to bring women's rights to the South when you're trying to impose these rights on a society that's simply not ready for them. You know, it's not the Taliban that are suppressing women's rights in the South. It is the rural conservative society that exists there. And you can't fight a war to bring these kinds of rights. The communities themselves must decide that that's what they want.
Will that change?
It's slowly changing. There's evidence. There are various programs to bring low-level politics and democracy. I mean, the irony is, although I study the war, what I keep saying to everyone, the most important thing that will transform society in Afghanistan and bring peace is local politics. It's the most important thing.
Have you been to Iraq?
Well, I haven't been to Iraq, actually. I'm just a one-war guy. I mean, I can just about manage Afghanistan. It's sufficiently complex that hopefully by the end of my career I'll have got on top of that. And so I haven't gone on to the second one.
David, you are a professor across the road here in University College Dublin. Mm-hmm. Do you love your job?
I do. I love my job. I love UCD. I love the smell of UCD. I mean, you know, memories are often smells. I know that sounds bizarre.
What's the smell?
You see, because my memory was of Earlsford Terrace. You know, Dad would have I think he was deputy registrar in those days or whatever the title would have been. And he had an office up on the top floor of Earlsford Terrace. And the smell of the polish. I remember when I came back in 2009, I dragged poor old Melissa to the National Concert Hall. I said, we're going there, not to hear the music, just so I could get the smell as I walked in the lobby. Of course, you don't get it anymore. But about 6 months later, I was going to give a talk in Earlsford Terrace, and I arrived early, and I was talking to the guy at the door about my experiences as a child. And he said, you want to come and have a look? So he pulled back a curtain, took out a key, opened a door, brought me up into the top floor. And the smell was still there.
I totally agree. And I remember as a child going into college with Dad, and there's a very strong smell, and then coming back as a student and having it. And then for 1 year, I was a lecturer in your department. Mm. And it's the same. The thing that hits you is a very distinctive smell that brings back memories.
Yeah. Do you think students that you lecture are as interested in politics as, you know, students might have been in the 60s, as people talk about when young people are really aware of politics? Are they as interested?
Oh, yes. Oh, almost certainly. You know, I'll have students who are active in any of the political parties. In fact, I was speaking at the Fianna Fáil Ardéis quite recently and bumped into a couple of my students there. Or at the Constitutional Convention, I bump into my students. So there's a huge interest in politics. In many ways, I think greater interest than I remember in my day.
You're a director of research for the Constitutional Convention, aren't you?
Yes.
Will it make a difference?
I think it's a start of something. You know, I'm part of a small group that's been arguing for this sort of thing for some time. And anyone who's been to a meeting of the Constitutional Convention come away with the same thing, which is, I was critical, I was cynical beforehand. Now I've seen how it operates. I can see that there's a role for something like this. So I'd love to see this model being pushed out into local politics, you know, discussions about local budgets, for example, or planning issues. This sort of thing has been done in other countries, and I'd love to see that here also.
I mean, for people who haven't been to the Constitutional Convention, simply put, what is it and how does it function and why does it matter?
Well, the government set it up. They said they were going to, and they fulfilled their promise. They were going to establish a convention with 66 citizens randomly selected from around the country and 33 politicians. And they're sitting at tables of eight with a trained facilitator at each table. So you've got a politician sitting cheek by jowl with somebody from a completely different walk of life. And their job is to discuss a particular issue for a weekend. So, for example, recently the discussion was about same-sex marriage. And we had experts in the room giving them briefings and telling them about the different sides of the various arguments. And then they had to come to a conclusion, which was, in this case, a recommendation that there should be same-sex marriage in Ireland.
You were also very involved in We the Citizens. You set that up, really, didn't you?
There was a bunch of us. There was Owen O'Malley, Jane Souter, Elaine Byrne and myself. We're very fortunate to get generous funding from Atlantic Philanthropies to establish We the Citizens with Fiach Mac Eneill as the chair of it, and we ran it for a whole year. And our mission was to try and demonstrate that this sort of model could be applied. And we're very happy to see that the Constitutional Convention in many ways follows that kind of model.
Interesting, though, you came back in 2009, David, in the most difficult time I can remember. People talk a lot about why aren't we like Greek? Why aren't people out in the street? What's your own analysis of a professor of politics? Why aren't we doing that? And do you think we're robust enough as a nation to survive what we're all going through?
I think robust is the telling phrase, isn't it? I mean, Greece is a recent democracy. And it's a country whose history is one of falling in and out of democracy over many generations. Whereas we are, in Ireland, it's often forgotten, I think, one of the longest established democracies in the world. So, you know, democracy is really built into our gene pool over many generations. And that's something you don't shake off too easily. So I think fundamentally for all the failings, and there's loads of failings, nobody's going to deny that, there still is some respect for our institutions. And some respect for the idea that it is through the institutions of representative democracy, if we're going to get out of this mess, that's how we're going to get out of it. So I think that's one of the strong reasons why we don't have the sort of things we've seen in Greece and in Spain.
Do you still discuss politics with your father?
Yeah, in some ways I am so lucky. I mean, I know for Theo and the other siblings, Bernard and Miriam, who are overseas, that they don't have the luxury I do of having regular contact. I see my father every Saturday. And I have him to myself. My mother's there as well, but it sort of feels like I have him to myself. And yeah, I talk politics. I talk about the sort of things that any son would want to talk to his father about and get advice from. And that continues to this day.
It's a slightly changed relationship now, isn't it? Because of your father's health.
Yeah, he has Parkinson's. He's had it for quite a while. He's been ill for quite a long time. He was ill before I came home. I remember how upset I was not being able to keep up with him in terms of, you know, all that period. So he's in a nursing home, and he's obviously affected by his Parkinson's, but he's still extremely lucid. He still loves his Irish. He loves singing. So, you know, every now and again, somebody wheels out a piano and he's off. It's like he's in a pub and he's singing some Irish song I couldn't even begin to remember, and they're all joining in. So he's his old self in so many ways.
Do you feel protective towards him now because he is more vulnerable?
Yeah, there is a bit of that, but I suspect that's the same in all families. We go through these generational shifts. But, I still have this thing there that I can talk to him about anything, and he will listen and he will give me advice. So the fatherly role is still there.
Is it more difficult, Theo, that unlike David, you live away?
I have the luxury that when I come back, I'll see Dad. And invariably, he's always in terrific form. And I think because they see me so infrequently, they are on top form when they see me. And I know afterwards, the following day, he'll be really tired. And we're very fortunate to have, you know, David and Rachel, and particularly Naomi, who live in Dublin and look after my parents. And Naomi has been the one who's picked up the major load and gladly. And that's what's really, I think, given myself and my sister Miriam and my brother Bernard great reassurance that we know all our siblings in Dublin, but especially Naomi, are looking after Mum and Dad.
What struck me by visiting him now, even with his Parkinson's, he's never changed. He's not bitter. He doesn't have self-pity.
Exactly right. No, I know that. And he's very dignified. He always was very dignified, and he remains like that.
I mean, he's fundamentally a happy man. He always has been.
Yeah.
And he remains such.
I mean, he, I think, can only stay in a wheelchair now, can't he? I mean, it has affected him physically.
Physically, he's weak. Absolutely. But his brain, as I said, is as good as ever.
Sharp.
And his long-term memory, my God. it's just crazy. He reminds me of things all the time, corrects me all the time on facts of history that I keep getting wrong. It's an incredible memory.
But look, we're coming to our last piece of music, which is a choice you want for your wife, Melissa. Actually, tell me the story about how you met your wife, Melissa.
Yeah, Melissa and I first met back in the 1985. I was a student in Florence. I was away for 3 years studying for my PhD. And I came back and my parents were having one of those parties where we all had friends along. And Rachel, my sister, had decided that one of her school friends, former school friends, might be somebody to meet. So Melissa and I met, and I had about a week to go before I went back to Italy. And we had a wonderful week together. And then I tried to persuade her to come back to Italy with me to live the last year there with me. And she declined, much to my huge regret. And we just drifted apart. And then, 25, 28 years later, we found each other again. And I had become a Bob Dylan fan in the meantime. I didn't know much about Bob Dylan in my youth. And as we were coming together and meeting again for the second time, this tune was in my head, and it summed up so much about the vision that was Melissa.
Why?
Well, because, you know, sometimes you meet somebody and they just blow you out of the water. It's the first sight. It's a bit like Theo with Elen, I suppose. When I met Melissa, I knew this was the person for me. And then I had so much regret about the fact that we never, you know, stayed together. And that can happen, I think, to many people in their relations. Mm. What might have been? What would have happened if we had stayed together? And I'm so lucky that I have what is. I found her again. She found me again. And, you know, she was perfect.
But look, it's been my real pleasure to have you both, David and Theo Farrell. My thanks on sound today to Noel Roberts, to my producer, Eileen Herron. And we're going to go out listening to Bob Dylan singing
Visions of Johanna.
Visions of Johanna.
Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.